Well, as you probably already know and are feeling, summer is a bit of a tricky business. I remember in my youth anyway, it's pretty much, other than Christmas, it's what I looked forward to all year long. It was back when we had summers. Some of you children don't even know what those are, but they used to be 3 months long, and school ended in May, and it didn't begin again until after Labor Day weekend. It didn't start until the first weekend of September. You had 3 full months of summer. And, you know, after a few weeks, yes, you were bored to death, but it was great because you weren't in school. But, of course, there is something glorious even in our adulthood about summer. You know, some of the busyness of life gets chopped away, even in our working world. You know, if the kids aren't in school and there aren't sports to be attending and practices to go to, or other events that seem to fill our calendars during the holiday seasons, summer feels like a bit of a reprieve from the busyness of life. And with that reprieve, we often make plans. You know, it's often summer vacations are planned, events are planned, you know, it's wedding season and so forth. And with all of that planning comes, of course, expectations. And it almost never fails to disappoint a bit. I have found that even in the most beautiful setting or the most relaxing situation, that does not keep one from, you know, bringing their sin nature with them, and, you know, some petty argument can erupt and spoil what would otherwise be something that is idyllic, and it's something that you've been waiting for, and yet here you are, you know, sitting in a bit of stubborn misery. Or have you ever planned and saved and spent all to go on a particular vacation, and then you just kind of went away feeling like, huh, like, was that all there was? Or maybe the kids didn't appreciate it as much as you thought they would, and still you come home without the money in the bank or even with the credit card bills still coming in the future, and you feel like there's just a little bit of disappointment even in the midst of the best things that you have tried to schedule. And then, of course, summer is over, and you have to wait 9 more months to try to redo and relive this perfect experience once again. And all that summer had held forth in hope, of course, didn't do all of the heavy lifting that we had wanted it to. And of course, summer is simply just a small snippet of the metaphor of life itself, that it's always just a bit of a disappointment. It never quite gives what it holds forth in promise. And yet that doesn't keep us from trying and trying again, much like the Rolling Stones once told us. Well, that is where we find our character this morning as she comes out for water, even if she doesn't know it. So the first thing I want us to see is that we are thirsty people. It helps a little bit to know the context of this story, at least the immediate context, which is John the Baptist leaving the scene of his ministry. And he leaves because he basically says, look, I'm just the forerunner. The bridegroom is here. And so as a member of the groom's party, it's not right for me to stay center stage. It is time for me to decrease and for him to increase. And therefore, he leaves off of his ministry to let Jesus take center stage in his gospel public ministry. And oddly, after that announcement that Christ is the bridegroom of the people of Israel, Jesus abruptly leaves Judea and enters what is considered foreign territory. He moves into Samaria. We are told that he had to pass through Samaria. And in the midst of these travels through this very arid and dry land, we see that Jesus has grown weary in his travels. It's noon, it's hot, it's time to rest. And so Jesus sets himself down at the well while his disciples go into town to get food. A well that, of course, was handed down from Jacob to his descendants. And then she enters alone, this Samaritan woman. And as we discussed in Luke's gospel, without going into all the details, of course, Samaritans were considered nothing short of an abomination. They were mixed breeds. They had false worship. They didn't just mix with Assyrian blood, the Jewish blood, but they also mixed false religions with the Jewish religion. There was everything that could be wrong from a Jewish perspective was wrong with Samaritans. In fact, even passing through Samaria was something that most Jews did not do. So here we meet the Samaritan woman, usually avoided at all costs. And if you could just get a little bit of flavor of the distaste, the Mishnah writes concerning Samaritan women, the daughters of the Samaritans are menstruants from the cradle. and therefore are perpetually in a state of ceremonial uncleanness. You know, if you don't understand all those words, good, it wasn't intended for you, but for those of you who did, you get the gist. But we should also see this specific Samaritan woman. And she comes by herself. She comes at noon, which is not typical. I mean, most of the women from town have already come out to the well in the morning when you go do the heavy lifting. You live in Temecula, you know what that's like. You know, you don't wait till 2 p.m. to do your yard work in the summer. You try to get it out of the way as early as possible. And yet she has chosen to come out at midday. And you'll notice she comes by herself, where this would typically be a social gathering, something that you do in the community, and you kind of, you know, talk and, you know, have your morning coffee, if you will, at the well, and then walk back into town. But because of what we'll learn about her, she's very intentionally coming by herself, because she would rather do the heavy lifting at the hottest part of the day than be around the other people in the community, because of the pain that that brings her and the shame that she experiences. And Jesus, ever the conversation starter, does the unthinkable. You'll notice the dynamic isn't just that she's a Samaritan, as the disciples say. They're like, "What are you doing talking to a woman? You know, a woman who's not your wife." So he approaches a woman in this culture, not highly acceptable, but not just any woman, a Samaritan woman, one that's already judged as unclean from the Jewish mindset, and he approaches her with this question. Or he approaches her with this question about, can you have a drink? And the woman knows the score. And she says, you know, "How is it that you're asking me for a drink? Jews don't have any associations with Samaritans. You know, why are you talking to me in this way?" And Jesus says, "If you knew who it was that was asking you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." And I love her response. She's like, "You don't even have anything to draw. You wouldn't be asking me for a drink right now if you could get your own drink. You know, you don't even have a cup to draw with. So how is this, you know, you're going to give me some sort of living water?" And Christ simply responds, "You know, you can go on drinking from this well if you want, but you will thirst again. But from the well that I have, you will never thirst again." And of course, as readers on this side of the story, we may know what's going on. But she, taking it at face value, says, "Well, that sounds pretty good. You know, I wouldn't be thirsty, and what's better is I wouldn't ever have to come back to the well again. I wouldn't have to make this journey and walk back with my heavy water pot. I wouldn't have to face the people of the community. So give me this water so that I no longer thirst." We run into this woman who, at least from the outset, has this outer thirst. The second thing we see is that she's seeking substitute thirst quenchers. I mean, what is living water? We read it in Jeremiah this morning. She's translating it simply as a flowing stream, this source of water that doesn't run out, right? You know, a brook that, you know, that comes from some sort of a waterhead, some source that never empties. You know, wouldn't that be wonderful to have something like that on your property or something like that nearby? But she's taking it just merely at the literal level, where Christ, of course, is pushing it further. As we saw in Jeremiah, Judah of old had been punished by God because of her idolatry, because they were dissatisfied with God himself. They wanted other things. And so this is what God says to them. "My people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters." So we have a definition. The fountain of living waters is God himself. "And instead, they've replaced me with cisterns that they've hewn out for themselves, broken cisterns that can hold no water." So they've made these water holdings, but they have cracks in them, so the water just seeps out and dissipates. And so this double sin for Judah was that they forsook God, and in his place, they started worshiping other gods, gods that would never satisfy the way that God, the God of Israel, had satisfied them. You know, he had been good to them. He had redeemed them. He had fed them along the way. He had protected them. He was their source, not only of life, but of sustenance and of their own redemption. And yet, in the face of all of that, they were seeking out other things, saying, "No, that doesn't make me happy. I want these things over there." And they did so by seeking out other gods that promised them those things. They traded in the God of provision for a God who can't help, can't heal, can't save. and can't protect. They, much like us, have sought satisfaction in all of these other ways other than the God who promises to be their ultimate source of satisfaction. I mean, the issue is source, and it's all of our issues. Basically, where will you find and identify the source of your greatest needs? Where will you find your ultimate satisfaction? And I think, again, we're in church right now, so we'll all say God. But if how we live Monday through Saturday may speak a completely different testimony. You know, how long we spend, you know, scrolling through our timeline or searching on OfferUp or, you know, looking through, you know, whatever sales of the week are going on or complaining about what we don't have. Those things tend to testify that we're not fully satisfied in God, or we would be a lot more content with certain things. But the reality is, no matter what we're doing, we're all seekers. We're all seeking satisfaction. And according to Scripture, according to God, that is ultimately a religious search. Wherever you find your deepest sense of satisfaction and hope and happiness, that is your God. It is religious. And everybody is incurably religious. It's not that there are some religious people and then non-religious people. Everyone's religious. It's just a matter of where one puts their faith or where one finds their ultimate hope. As David Foster Wallace wrote, and I've mentioned before, he says, here's something else that's true. And this is written not from a Christian, but at this point an avowed atheist, and he changed his mind a bit as time went on. He says, in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then they will never be enough. Russell Brand, the actor, many of you know, in his book on recovery, says very much the same thing. He says, every time I reinvest in the material world as a potential source of happiness, I'm able to return to that material world when it fails me. When religions talk of idolatry, I feel I know what they are saying. When I make something else my symbol of the divine, I always get in trouble. I mean, don't get too wrapped up in relationships or money. Sounds like the sort of thing a grandparent might say. But I have an inclination to make these things constantly my salvation. It's interesting. Two people who did not accept the faith in any way, both saying very plainly, look, we're all religious people. And what the basis of religion is that we need to worship something, we need to seek something that will make us whole or happy or satisfied. And both say, the problem with seeking it in this material world or in the things of this life is they always come up just a little bit short. Well, after Christ makes this offer of living water, she agrees. I mean, she's in. She'll take some, especially if it means she doesn't have to come back to the well in this way. And then Jesus, oddly, after offering it to her, says, well, go get your husband first. As if, like, you know, I'm not selling it to you until he gets here or whatever. And it does seem odd. I mean, literarily it's odd. It's just an out-of-the-nowhere statement. And so what is Jesus doing? She needs water. He offers it. And he says, get your husband down here, and then we can talk about it. Well, before he will draw water for her, if you will, he wants to draw her out of herself. And so her response is, I don't have one. Jesus says, you're right, that's a good answer. You don't have one. You've had five. And the one that you have now isn't even your husband. He's, you know, just shacking up with him. Obviously not having known him before, she says, I perceive that you might be a prophet. And what's going on? Why the seeming shift? Why does Jesus go from water to marriage here? Again, which seems like a radical turn. Well, for a couple of reasons. First, because this dear woman who loves Jesus doesn't get it yet. This woman whom Jesus loves doesn't get it yet. She doesn't get just how thirsty she actually is. both in the modern sense and in the ancient sense. She doesn't realize that coming out for water in the heat of the day isn't her biggest problem, but it does expose it a little bit. She is dissatisfied. And she has sought love and fulfillment in five husbands, and having found none, is now shacking up with somebody at present. And obviously we don't know whose fault all of those disillusions of marriage were, or if she lost them all to death. But the fact that now she's not married to the sixth makes it seem that there's probably some sort of scandalous nature, at least in that relationship. And the fact that she's coming out alone lets us know at least she's ashamed in the eyes of the community. She is not held in high esteem. And she comes out in the heat of the day because of that shame, because she has tried and tried again, and she has not been able to satisfy this longing for love and the satisfaction she desires from it. She's looking for love in all the wrong places, and Jesus is trying to drive her from the merely physical to the deeper things that she's actually seeking. She's been drawing and drawing from the wells of this world, not knowing that the pot that she's using has holes in it, so she always has to go back for more, and it never is quite enough, even five husbands in. One husband, no satisfaction, and so she tries and tries and tries, but five in, no satisfaction. She wants something, she just can't quite find it. She's scratching something, but the itch is never quite satisfied. In C.S. Lewis's book, The Silver Chair, maybe you'll remember the scene. You can't help but think it's somewhat based on this text, where Jill finds herself lost and thirsty in a strange land. And there she sees a brook, but Aslan lies in front of the brook. If she's going to get any water, she has to pass by him to get it. And he growls to her and then tells her she may come and drink, which seems like opposite invitations. And so she says, may I? Could I? Would you mind walking away while I drink? The lion answered with a look and a very low growl, and as Jill gazed at his motionless bulk, she realized that she might as well have asked the whole mountain to move aside for her convenience. The delicious rippling noise of the stream was driving her nearly frantic. Do you promise not to do anything if I do come? Said Jill. I make no promise, said the lion. Jill was so thirsty now that without noticing it, she had taken a step nearer. Do you eat girls? She said. I have swallowed up girls and boys, women and men, kings and emperors, cities and realms, said the lion. It didn't say this as if it were boasting, nor as if it were sorry, nor as if it were angry. It just said it. Well, I daren't come and drink, said Jill. Then you will die of thirst, said the lion. Oh dear, said Jill, coming up another step closer. I suppose I must go and look for another stream then. And listen to this final conclusion. There is no other stream, said the lion. That is the first reason that Jesus tells her to call her husband. It's to teach her the reality that you've been looking for a water source elsewhere and there is no other stream. She needs to have revealed to her by this application, really, of the law, Jesus saying to her, go ahead, grab your husband, only to expose that her seeking husbands has clearly been something that has left her wanting. And so our final movement of the story this morning is leaving our pots. And so he brings up her husband, yes, to condemn her. You have tried, you want love, you have desire, you've scratched, but you still itch, you're still thirsty. But what you need is living water. So what is that? Well, it's what we learned in Jeremiah. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters. Jesus is offering himself to her. He's saying what you can have is me, but not just saying you can have me as a source of water. He's saying you can have me as your husband. We say, oh, I get it. Jesus is enough. But do you get it? Is Jesus really enough? We all want love. We all want success. We all want certain things, material comfort. And the way that those things often pull on our desires, it shows that we don't find Jesus fully enough because when he does grant us things, we find ourselves discontented with those things. Or We ignore him completely in our pursuit of those things. Every time we sin, we're saying that Jesus isn't enough. And what is amazing that is in the kindness of God, even though he knows that, he also tenderly comes to us and wants us to know that the way that we're seeking it is just never going to work out for us. And he's not going to let the things of this world ultimately satisfy so that we will never stop having to turn to him in our time of need. I mean, he really is the thing you're seeking in all of your wanting, no matter where you're seeking it. In a 1945 novel, The World, the Flesh, and Father Smith, written by a Scottish writer, Bruce Marshall, there is a quote that comes up from time to time that is found in this particular book. Father Smith, the protagonist, while walking home one day, encounters a beautiful and yet seductive young woman standing on her front stoop. And this woman, provocatively accented by her frock, blowing all around her lovely legs. She introduces herself to Father Smith, and as the author of the best-selling novel, that is a bit scandalous, and she says, "But perhaps you haven't read it." So she asks the priest, "Tell me, do you get much response to the old story these days?" She said. She, a modernist, had long rejected, of course, all that poppycock about baptism and purity and the virgin birth because, of course, quote, "it's against all the modern science and obstetrics. Sorry, wow. She explains to our cleric that she's been dying for years to meet a Catholic priest, but somehow there never seems to be any at any of the parties that she goes to. So he invited her to walk along for his next appointment was coming, and he had to go away. And among many questions built upon her judgments of the silliness of his faith, she asked about his own sexuality and how he manages to put, as she put it, live without us, you know, the females. Easily and confidently, he answered, "But your female body too will grow old and sag. And always the contemplation of them, even at their best, is a poor and boring substitute for walking with God in his house as a friend." And so notice he says, you hold up this ideal of, you know, feminine sexuality, and he says, even in its best, it will always fade, and it's nothing compared to being a friend of God. To which she says, "Oh, it's just a lie. Religion's just a substitute for things that you can't have that you want, like sensual desires." And he counters her roundly, "I still prefer to believe that sex is a substitute for religion, and that the young man who rings the bell at the brothel is unconsciously looking for God." What he means by that is every time we seek something in this life that we think, if I have this, it will finally satisfy, it's just a faint substitute for the real search that we're on, this eternal well that springs forth into eternal life. God himself who promises to give us utter satisfaction. And it's what we want, but of course we will never seek it the way that the Bible puts forth because we always think that our ways are wiser than God's. So Jesus comes to her to give her what she truly needs, not just water, but a faithful husband who will love her thoroughly and know her even as she desires to be known. And we can know this is true not merely by the mention of her husband, but the way that John sets the scene, and I'll need to do this quickly for sake of time. I mean, we find in this scene something that we should recognize, a woman at a well in a foreign country. You've heard the story before, whether you know it or not. I mean, it's the story of Isaac and Rebekah, the first couple in the Bible whose love story begins at a well in a foreign country when a bride is being sought, and after being sought, the one seeking the bride is invited over for hospitality, and it ends in a wedding. But of course, it's not just Isaac and Rebekah. It's also Jacob and Rachel and Leah, when they, of course, meet in a foreign country at a well. They're brought back home, given hospitality, and the story ends in a wedding. Or Moses journeying into Midian, where he encounters, shockingly, a woman at a well. Defends them, draws water for them at the well, and the women go quickly home and tell their father about Moses. He's invited to dinner, he stays with them, and leaves with a wife. And interestingly enough, we have Jesus here in a foreign country, meeting a woman at a well, asking for a drink, and the first thing she does after he offers her this life and after confrontation is she hurries home to tell all of her people, and they invite him to stay for hospitality for 2 days, and many believed on him because of her testimony and then the teaching of Christ. And how is this a marriage? Well, it begins with her saying, Jews and Samaritans have no dealings with one another, and it ends with her saying, come and see the man who told me everything I had ever done, and putting her faith in him as the true Christ who was to come. I mean, wedding imagery was used by the prophets to describe the glorious age in which we live, in which this woman is now invited, this non-Jewish woman, into the family of God. Your husband is your maker, says Isaiah. For the Lord has called you like a wife forsaken and grieved in spirit. Or he says again, as a bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so God will rejoice over you, his people. Or Hosea, and I will betroth myself to you forever. I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness. Jesus has just called himself the bridegroom, or John has just called Jesus the bridegroom in chapter 3. Jesus has just done his first miracle at a wedding of turning water into wine and saying the new age where the mountains drip with wine has come upon you. And he just so happens in the very next story, after being called the bridegroom, travel into Samaria, meet a woman at a well, confront her about her husband's, and challenge her to trust on him in order that she might find fullness and satisfaction in the fountain of living waters. She leaves, married once again, but this time eternally, to one who will ever be faithful to her, and who, while she may still struggle with satisfaction in this life, will never leave her ultimately wanting, as when she sees him, she will be like him and be conformed into his image and truly be wed to him forever, fully satisfied by his embrace. This life will always leave us thirsty, and Jesus and the life he is bringing in the gospel promise final eternal satisfaction. They tell you, I mean, all the things in this life, both the way that they tempt us and the way that they let us down, tell us very clearly there is no other stream. But there is a stream. It's just not here. You'll never find it here. And if you're still young enough to believe that it is here, I encourage you, when you finally, the bottom falls out and you realize that all of the nicest things break and all of the best people let you down, and even the best people that you love with all of your heart, you also will dislike intensely at certain times. All of those things are mere reminders that this place will never, ever be enough. It'll never satisfy. But let that be the law that pushes you to a gospel of a son who comes and offers himself to you as true satisfaction, the one who came and hung upon a cross and cried out, even on that cross, I thirst, so that you and I would never have to thirst again if we place our faith in him, at least not ultimately. We'll learn in Ecclesiastes, we thirst plenty, even as Christians. This life is hard, even as Christians, and it seems senseless, even as Christians, but not ultimately so. And because of the not ultimately so, this life then is infused again with true meaning and joy. Remember what Jeremiah said. My people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living water. They've hewed out themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. And look at what it says in verse 28. And so the woman left her water jar and went into the town and said to the people, listen to the man who told me everything I've ever done. Why does John bother telling us that she left her water jar? It's such an unnecessary detail. We're in this deep philosophical conversation about true worship. She believes he's the Christ. Now she leaves, and he goes, and she just left her pot behind. To reinforce this very point, that she was thirsty for things in this life, including this water from this well that were never satisfied, and she believes on Christ sufficiently to say, I'm leaving these things behind. I'm putting my hope in him. I mean, she gets it. The question is, do we? Are you thirsty? Are you dissatisfied? If you are, and you are, it's because we focus oftentimes on the gifts above the giver of the gifts. We spent too much time trying to quench our thirst using broken pots that won't hold water. But Christ comes to give us water that makes alive, and those who give themselves to Him in faith over and over again will find that life, and that life abundant. And so may we trust in Him afresh this morning when everything else in life seems to be a letdown. Let's pray.